Okay, yeah, so I'm stepping in very temporarily here for Peter, I think, just because I tend to be a regular at these things, but happy to try to introduce Alex and set us up for the discussion. I think Peter will join us halfway through or maybe an hour in. So I'm just a temporary stand-in. Alex is, I think, well known to everybody who takes part in the forum as one of the co-founders of the forum. So if anybody knows the tactics of how to approach a 90-minute Football Scholars Forum session, I think Alex would be the man. He's shared with everybody a chapter, the first chapter from his dissertation, Dreaming of Sports City, Consumption, Urban Transformation, and Soccer Clubs in Buenos Aires, which he is expecting to defend in May of 2016. Hopefully we're on track for that. Alex is currently a digital liberal arts fellow through the Mellon Scholars Program at Hope College. His research in Argentina has been funded by Fulbright Scholarship and Joao Havelange FIFA Scholarship. So if anybody detects a little bit of bias, deference to FIFA kleptocrats, you'll know where that's coming from. I think the general process here is that Alex will give a little bit of an introduction to his work and a little bit of context for the paper we read, and then people are welcome to use the Skype message system to queue up for questions. And again, as the temporary moderator, as the the Gerard Martino to Peter's Diego Maradona. I'll just sort of call on people in the order that they put their names into the Skype message system mix. But without further ado, Alex, we're all interested to hear more about your work and the chapter that you gave us all to read.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. I just wanted to say a few brief things about the chapter just to give a better sense of where it's sitting in the dissertation. That defense date is likely a little bit ambitious now. I have Ed Murphy, my advisor, sitting next to me here as well. So we're kind of chuckling at that. But yeah, the first chapter, as I've heard many people say, was definitely the hardest to write. It's an interesting chapter in a lot of ways because it counts a lot on the colleagues' work that I've always drawn on in Argentina, one of whom, Mariano Gruchetsky, might be joining us a little bit later. But he was also, in some ways, the one that inspired me to look at the Ciudad Deportiva as well. So it feels good now to be rolling on Chapter 3. Chapter 2 is in a little bit of a rough state, but it's allowed me to get closer to the primary sources that were kind of some of the more original things that I was looking at for the first time, whereas the first chapter, my contributions in terms of original sources are mainly focused on Boca and the Peronisters. So it's an exciting time to be writing. I'm also very grateful and happy that this group has continued far enough along for me to be able to engage with it for my own work. The things that are getting interesting now, too, with the third chapter are that I'm getting into the kind of the main narrative of the story of the Ciudad Deportiva. So it's writing that's coming a little bit easier, and it's writing that's benefiting from the revisions that I've done on this first chapter to kind of ground what the story it is that I really want to tell and why it matters. It's also getting interesting because Macri is former president of Boca Juniors, is the runoff opponent to Daniel Scioli, who's the Peronist candidate, and Macri is the kind of new neoliberal candidate in Argentina. So things might get even more interesting if he wins the runoff in 10 days, but not projected. I'd be surprised if he does, but then again, it was a surprise that his party won the province as well. So things could get even more interesting for the kind of story that I'm telling, as I describe it, kind of this hegemonic shift between the welfare state in the 1940s and kind of the neoliberal turn that happens towards the end of the story of the Ciudad Deportiva. So yeah, I'm really excited to hear what you all thought of me putting together the the stage on which the later chapters will stand. In a lot of ways, it's just kind of me contextualizing why Boca Juniors is able to do something like the Ciudad Deportiva, and that was the overwhelming focus of the first chapter, is to contextualize its arrival in Buenos Aires and its significance in the city. So I'm excited to hear from everyone what they thought.
Great. Thanks, Alex. Looks like Brenda first in the queue, and Javier has a question that maybe we can take after Brenda. Brenda, are you up for it?
Yeah, sure. This is great reading this, and it's exciting to see how it's come along, Alex. Congratulations on diving fully into the dissertation writing. I had a question on how you sort of place this early history, now that we have several monographs in Latin American history that deal with the early period of football and politics in a Latin American, in a regional context. So how do you see Argentina vis-a-vis Brazil and Chile in the early 20th century? Because this chapter, it sounds like so familiar to me in terms of Chile and Brazil, but I don't know, maybe there's some really interesting differences too. I was wondering if you could talk about it a little bit.
Yeah. One of the main tasks for revising this chapter has been to contextualize it within what's happening in the other major cities. It's something that I haven't done yet, but I have some impressions of how I'm going to talk about that. I think from kind of a first blush of what I want to focus as interesting about the Buenos Aires case is the scale of the urban explosion is in some ways a familiar story, but I think in Buenos Aires it takes a particular form with the barrios. So I lay out what the kind of web of civic associations that exist in the barrios are. I want to go further into demonstrating how they're actually speaking to one another, how the same kinds of people are serving on multiple boards in these civic associations. And I think that's kind of one of the first places that I'd like to look at when I do more digging on Sao Paulo and Rio and Montevideo and Santiago, to find out if my hunch on what is particular about Buenos Aires is something that I can actually sustain in an argument when I bring it in to conversation with the rest of the cities. I also think the number of clubs and the kind of anchor they provide as an area of growth for certain neighborhoods is something I suspect I'll find is something that's unique in terms of the scale of the North, West, and South all having major clubs that serve this function of, being in the same conversation of asking for public services to be provided or speaking to the municipality in a certain kind of language to ask for those services. But the shorter answer is, I'm not there yet in this chapter, and I have a hunch on where I'm going to make contributions on what's specific to Buenos Aires, and I'm going to still learn some more things about what's a familiar story.
Thanks, Alex.
Mm-hmm. Javier has a question he's written on the message system. Javier, do you want to ask it directly, or should we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Well, first, congratulations, Alex. Your dissertation is coming along, and we are waiting. We cannot wait for be ready so that we can enjoy it, because you have a lot of research already done, and it's a very promising project. My question has to do with the connections between film and soccer, and more specifically with the connections between mass media and the construction of soccer as a national space in Argentina. And I'm thinking about two movies, Los Tres Berretines from 1933 and Pelota de Trapo, in which the cinematic construction, cinematic narrative, places soccer above family, ethnicity, and health issues, because in Pelota de Trapo, the guy has like a heart condition and he might die while he plays, you know, for Argentina against Brazil, and he decides to play and win at the end. So my question is, what do you think is the role of social media or mass media between 1920 and 1950? You talk about radio and newspapers, but also cinema, if you could include cinema in that, in shaping soccer into this sort of a supra-ethnic space that is replacing immigrant masculinities, immigrant narratives, ethnic identities, and using the field as sort of melting pot for the entire nation.
Yeah, here I'm drawing a lot on both Matthew Carusha's work and Rouhani. A lot of conversations I've had with Rouhani, who has talked about his work a little bit in the forum as well. But Rouhani's dissertation really is driven, a lot of his primary sources that drive his narrative are film. So he has a lot of interesting things to say about this that I want to bring the first chapter into conversation with. But I think a direction that I want to take the first chapter in is moving away from what I talk about as happening in Buenos Aires into a more national context, because a lot of the secondary sources that I'm drawing on are talking about kind of the creation of the mass media as a reflection of the emergence of a consumer society. Mm-hmm. So I don't know beyond what I'm drawing on in the secondary sources to take a look at in what I have as primary sources to make it a more kind of national conversations. One direction that might be interesting to take it is what the magazines that I do have from between this period, between the 20s and the 50s, always do at the end, especially the club specific magazines, which is they always have a kind of like a roll call of all the peñas that the club has nationally. And Boca and River always have, you know, at least two or three pages of photos that the fan clubs that are outside of Capital Federal and in other provinces send in to say, you know, we celebrated this victory, or we do our, you know, monthly meeting. There's lots of images in these magazines that I'm not sure if it can help us trace how a club like Boca becomes a national club and how the mass media plays a role in having what's traditionally known as the five big clubs in Buenos Aires become national clubs. But that's maybe where I'd like to take what you're pointing to, Javier.
Great. And then the second question was about the role of these voluntary associations that have a sports component and their connection with local politics, mm-hmm. and access to public space and access to power in general. From what I got working on soccer clubs by people of Mexican descent in Detroit and in Chicago in the 1940s and 1950s, is that these soccer clubs are going to provide with an opportunity for these associations to establish a pattern of negotiation with the cities, and to create this sort of a local power agencies by which they can have access to public facilities, but then after that, they can have access to becoming public officials or representatives of the community or members of the Mexican community in the United States at a very prominent place. So you mentioned a little bit about some representatives of Boca that were also having official positions at the government. But I wonder if you would like to talk a little more about mm-hmm. these connections between local politics and these soccer clubs.
Yeah. Sometimes it's people who are all part of the same conversation or are of the same political party who serve on the boards of the clubs and then also use that connection to really open up a conversation. What's interesting that you're talking about in Detroit with Mexican-American communities is what's interesting about Buenos Aires and what I've seen as being a little bit different about Buenos Aires is that while there is a way that that conversation that gets opened up between directors and politicians is about access to certain kinds of services or access to certain kinds of services. The clubs are often not asking for access, but asking for subsidies to build their own infrastructure that then they make the argument is a public service in itself. So instead of saying, as the club in La Boca, we're going to ask for the municipality to build more green space or build a park. Boca says, you know, give us subsidies and provide us with help in building our own facilities that are our facilities that then, in some kind of, and this is, you know, a criticism that other politicians make, in some kind of vague connection is going to help the entire community, even though it's Boca. So there's people that critique that, but there's also a way, and that's a really powerful argument that continues to be very convincing, that even if it's the club's facilities, it benefits the kind of the nearby urban landscape as well. I'm kind of forgetting I kind of got sidetracked on answering your question. The main part of your question, Javier, though, was on...
Yeah, we have detected that, like the construction of a permanent channel by which people that are leaders in these voluntary associations have access to political positions per se.
Yeah, I think if I was able to, and this is something that I can do in later chapters because I have more sources to follow the people these people's careers. I have more sources to actually see where they start and where they end up, both in the club directorship and in political positions. But in the time period we're talking about, I can't kind of trace those political careers. But what I know from what other people have written about and what I'm drawing on in terms of the secondary literature, the conversation is always staying open, but it's not kind of part of a political machinery or part of a party machinery to occupy a certain position in the club and then later occupy a certain position with a party, because the clubs mostly have to keep a somewhat diverse base of club directors so that if there is a party that's in power nationally but a different party that's in power at the municipal level, they can have a conversation with either side of the political spectrum or either side of the party machinery to make sure that the conversation stays open no matter who's in power. It breaks down sometimes, though, because Armando, who was kind of a squishy Peronist in some ways, he gets thrown in jail after 55, which is something I didn't know when I was writing about this for a while. I thought I didn't know that anything had happened to Armando, except that he had appointed maybe the second in command that was more acceptable to the elites, that wanted to kind of cleanse civic associations, political associations, everything they had power over of Peronist influence. I thought this was kind of pointing to what a lot of my colleagues in Argentina have said, that the clubs always have to be nimble in their politics, and they have to have boards of directors that enable that kind of agility. It does break down sometimes, and you are found to be on the wrong side of the fence, and there's consequences for it. But often that gets addressed in the next election, and the opposition party can then make the argument that they're going to have a better channel to the municipality or to the state to put the club's interests first.
It's like we've got a queue building up here. So Matt, and then Chris H, then Chris B, then Melissa and Martha. But Matt,
yeah, excellent. Thanks so much, Alex, for sharing this chapter. It's I'm working on a similar kind of chapter in my dissertation, so it's really refreshing to see that I'm on a similar page as you. one thing I'd like, sort of as a basic elaboration, is how you're seeing consumption and how you see consumption shift in the major moments of change that you're going to be really dealing with as Boca first starts planning the Ciudad Deportiva, and then all of a sudden that project becoming untenable for them, and what it is, the link to how people are actuating themselves in the city is changing through that concept.
Okay, yeah, so how's consumption changing throughout?
Yeah. And how is that kind of linked to what you're seeing as the way in which people are relating to football?
Yeah, I think where things really get interesting is when clubs in the 20s, while they're already large institutions with big memberships, they're still largely in the business of filling the stadium with as many people as they can. So, you know, it's a kind of consumption that already has a very mass appeal to it. There's a way that the city's animated on the weekends by consuming soccer, and that it in some ways illuminates how the city's transforming, because it's the public transportation network that's being engaged. It's the creation of a specialized sports press that has already been popular, but is becoming more and more popular. But I think things get really interesting in the 20s, because that's when the clubs start to expand beyond soccer to have kind of a larger set of activities available for dues-paying members. And so then what is able to be consumed by a member of the club becomes a wider set of activities, and the consumer market itself is becoming more sophisticated in the 30s and 40s. In the 40s, of course, with Peronism, we have, you know, a lot of rich things to dig into with the political meanings of certain kinds of consumptions and where you're consuming what. But largely, the clubs are an interesting place to look at consumption in the Peronist years, because it's already a point where, especially the larger clubs that have large sets of infrastructure, have members from all kinds of political backgrounds and live in different parts of the city. There's, I think, statements we can make about Vélez having a certain different kind of membership base than say Boca even. But they're, as my colleagues in Argentina put it, they're policlasista. They're kind of diverse in their constituencies, who's paying membership dues to have some kind of expanded set of activities that they can enjoy at the club. And then in the 50s and 60s, I think the Ciudad Deportiva is responding to another shift in both the politics of consumption and what consumption looks like in the city, because it's based around the family in a way that's a continuity from the 1940s, but it's also different, because I think it's really based around, it's similar. It is still different in some ways. I think it's much more explicitly about a modern family consuming these things. I think there's continuities from Peronism in that being a sign of national progress, of who can have access to the good things in life. But I think in the 50s and 60s, what the Ciudad Deportiva is really putting front and center is a certain kind of family consumption that is reflected in the kinds of really diverse activities that are available to Ciudad Deportiva. So if in the late 20s, 30s, and 40s, it's a more broader set of things you can consume at the soccer club, it is still primarily amateur athletics, you know, cultural and social activities, dances. There is kind of a set kind of routine, a retinue of kinds of activities you can consume, whereas the Ciudad Deportiva is really kind of the focused on the novel, you know, drive-in movie theater and the aquarium. These are things that are supposed to draw families because they are so new and you can't consume them anywhere else. It's not a part of what you would always be expecting for families to do with their free time. Does that answer your question, Matt?
Yeah, and I guess kind of as a follow-up, what do you see as happening in the 1980s and 90s as kind of the clubs move away from that relationship and towards more of a European or North American style relationship, particularly in Boca, where they're promoting more of a brand image and you are to consume the brand of Boca more than to interact through Boca.
Yeah, again, I think it's a mix of old and new. I think in some ways the kind of branding and international stage that brings a lot of, there's, you know, prestige ascribed to, and there's money to be made in the Copa Libertadores as far as back as the 60s. But I think kind of the branding, especially at a club that Boca can capitalize on when they're participating in these kinds of international competitions, becomes greater. So I think those are some of the new things. The governance is also changing. There's an attempt to privatize clubs in Argentina as well. This is stuff that I'm still learning about and that I still have some planning to do on how I bring it into the argument with the sources that I do know I have that will be in the last chapter. But there's also continuities, I think, between members, directors, and fans of the club that have an expectation that their needs will be met outside of being guaranteed a winning team. So it's an old tension that I think comes out in different ways because of what's happening kind of in the wider national economic context in Argentina. But I still have to get to a lot of that stuff, so I'm excited to learn more about it and see how it gels with my argument. But there's I think things that are transformative about the 80s and 90s that I see at Boca for sure.
Excellent. Chris Henderson?
Hi, Alex. This has really been good for me because I'm beginning my own sort of path through graduate writing and the dissertation and looking at Argentina as one potential place of study. My question is around this idea of governance and really curious about how membership works as a structure, how the clubs are structured in this sort of quasi-democratic way, and how that affects then their ability to work as political entities.
Yeah, that's a part of the introduction that I'm really excited to write, actually. It's going to be really fun to write those pages of saying, okay, you know, I've kind of teased everyone saying, look at what the clubs were capable of doing, look at their place in the urban landscape, like how do they actually work? Because it's a fascinating thing. The Reader's Digest version is you have these clubs founded by small groups of young men. They then have, you know, 7 or 8 reserve squads competing at different levels, ones that become very successful, and those are all the members. They pay dues because they want to have field space and they want to play. But then the dues paying membership base becomes wider and wider as people want to watch them play, and then wider and wider as they want to participate in what the club offers beyond spectatorship of the winning team. So all these socios, these dues-paying members, they elect the Comisión Directiva, the board of directors, that usually later when they become larger also has a kind of mesa de representantes that is kind of the sort of House of Representatives wing of the club governance structure. So you have a board of directors at the top. You have, usually appointed by the board of directors, a leadership around the members assembly, and then you have members that select or elect their representatives. So Boca, for example, has 200 representatives that are allowed to show up at the asambleas. But until the 1950s, anybody could show up at the meeting, and the Comisión Directiva had to be at that members' meeting. Now they don't have to be. They can just have one member of the Comisión Directiva as a representative there. So, yeah, you see steadily throughout the years, a distancing of the Comisión Directiva from how much they have to interact with the most grassroots level of politics. But everything I've just said is specific to Boca. It's generally applicable to other clubs. Every club has members that elect a board of directors, but each club has different statutes that determine how the representatives interact with that board of directors. And there's different moments at different clubs where either through a more authoritarian club director, the statutes are reformed to make it less participatory, or you have a club like Vélez Sarsfield that's always held up as kind of a model of governance that does include dues-paying members. The big interesting question too at Boca is that there's a whole category of dues-paying members called socios adherentes that don't really have any claims, especially claims to governance, participation in governance, than a normal dues-paying member does. But it was a way to, you know, some would say it was a way to have people have access to the stadium for when tickets fell through. More cynical interpretations are it was a way to kind of bolster the finances of the club and have, even though they're not voting members, a group of members that would be invested in that kind of a structure continuing that has fit in some convenient ways into Macri's kind of political machine at Boca, because the current president of Boca is part of the Pro party. He's kind of a Macri guy in that way.
Thank you. It's fascinating. Absolutely.
Great. Chris Brown?
Okay. Thank you, Alex. I have a follow-up to that one, and then my own question. The follow-up would be, where are these ideas on how to organize the club coming from? Are they being shared consciously between clubs? Are they coming from other countries? And then the second question is, to what extent and when could you write your story using another club? Obviously, the Ciudad Deportiva is a special case, but how much is the story of Boca unique, and when is it unique, and when do we need to know that it's unique?
Sure. Okay, so where does the governance come from? It's very much in the tradition of the previously existing civic associations. So you have, going back to confraternities, this kind of governance model, but also the sociedades de fomento. There's things like libraries, bibliotecas populares. All of these are, we would call them non-profit civic associations, but they have personería jurídica, they have their legal entities that, because they are oriented towards the public good, they must provide annual records, and they must have a democratic model of governance. So that's where it comes from. It comes out of the kind of milieu of other civic associations that are really tasked with just dealing with the functions of everyday life in the city, because the city explodes so rapidly that the municipal governance structures are playing catch up. In some ways, they're still playing catch up with addressing, you know, what's happening with recently arrived immigrants and what the neighborhoods are transforming into. Then your question was, where is Boca's story unique, and where do I have to say that it's unique and doesn't apply to other clubs, essentially?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, Boca's unique in a lot of ways, but it can tell a story of the large clubs at the same time, in the sense that I'm going to talk about the big five. So you have River, San Lorenzo, Independiente, Racing, and Boca. In some ways, you can talk about those five clubs as similar clubs because of their scale. Because they are considered national clubs, they have, you know, wide membership bases that aren't in Buenos Aires, and because they're successful professionally successful. So some of the things that happen at Boca in terms of its governance structure, in terms of the kinds of projects like the Ciudad Deportiva, other clubs have attempts that they even call Ciudades Deportivas. San Lorenzo has its own. Independiente tries to build a big water park, essentially. But Boca's unique in that it has a mythology built around its neighborhood that is unlike other clubs. You could say San Lorenzo has a similar kind of story, and Racing and Independiente as well have, you know, always been Avellaneda's clubs, but San Lorenzo, you know, isn't still in its kind of mythological home, largely because of national politics and what happened under the military dictatorship, which is why there a campaign for them to, Matt's actually writing about this, Matt Hawkins is writing about this, San Lorenzo's campaign to go back to Boedo. But Boca's unique in that way, in that they have a whole mythology built, which has everything to do with their branding around their place in La Boca. Their stadium is also unique. It's created a certain kind of dynamic for their professional team's life and economics, because the stadium is such a hot ticket. It also, you know, very rarely has anything other than Boca games going on in it. And yeah, I'd say it's also unique in that it's only River is the only other club that I think can harness the kind of widespread investment and support that Boca showed it could marshal with the Ciudad Deportiva. Yeah.
Thank you, Alex.
Yeah. I think Ed has a question.
I do, and I'm sorry, it's hard for me to type over because Alex is talking into the computer, so it's kind of awkward for me to jump in. So let me get in on the queue there whenever I can. So this is Ed with Alex in East Lansing. Okay, I don't need to go right away. We can let the other people go.
Okay, great. We'll have, I think we have Melissa and then Martha, and then we'll throw Ed in after that, if that works.
Great.
Melissa.
Hi. So my question is semi-formulated. I've not wanting to formulate it perfectly. I've been wanting to listen to the answers to the other questions. But so first, I was wondering if this chapter you gave us, if there's going to be an introductory chapter before that, because mm-hmm. that might address some of my question, which is, so you're talking about citizenship, gender, urban transformation, modernization, and you know how. What you see as citizenship, how you understand it, how it's being constructed, doesn't really come through clearly in this chapter. So mm-hmm. I was wondering if it comes in another place, because this is precisely that moment of, you know, modernization, that sort of social control of bringing people into the state. So on the one hand, you have, you know, the soccer clubs helping Argentina construct a particular view of the nation, and obviously masculinity is part of that. But at the same time, the hygiene, sports as hygiene, mm-hmm. and, you know, looking at poverty is a way to bring people into the state in a very narrow way. So I was thinking about this because it happened all over Latin America, the U.S., the way that the hygiene and the institutionalization of medicine become a way to create those gender roles and family structures. Mm-hmm. You know, women work in these voluntary associations to try to uplift the lower classes so that they become respectable, all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of curious, on the one hand, what role women are playing in the, you know, what roles they're playing in these structures. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also wondering whether you see soccer consolidating a middle-class whiteness, because I think there's a way that, you know, you put that the ideal citizen is white. Mm-hmm. If soccer helped consolidate a whiteness in, you know, European whiteness in Latin America, you know, in Argentina as a space of European whiteness, mm-hmm. and middle classness. So that's that question. The second question you don't have to answer now, but I'm just curious about the methodology, you know, how you found bringing ethnography and history together in this work. So that's just a kind of a separate one.
Okay.
Two small questions for you.
Two small questions.
Sorry.
No, thanks, Melissa. No, they're great.
Great questions.
Great questions. Yeah. And they're, yeah, I think Ed says so too, because they echo some of the things Ed's been pushing me on as well. Okay. So first, yes. Yeah, there is an introduction to be written that will deal explicitly with all of this, actually. Yeah, I definitely see this as part of a moment that, while modernization is something that comes up in my sources, in the first chapters before the 50s, I'm gonna need to use it as an analytical term, because it's not just popping up enough for me to do much with it as a native term. What are women doing in these structures? So one of the interesting things that I want to do with, we have a, and this addresses kind of the methodology question too. One of the things that I'm working on right now is that we have the main source that we draw on for the club annual records, the Memorias Gibelenses. We have many of them on many hard drives in a community of people who look at soccer in Buenos Aires. I want to have a database that lets me do some analysis of very interesting ways that data appears in these Memorias Gibelenses. So for starting the 20s, really, you can have all the membership roles distinguished by youth categories and women as a category as well. So I can, you know, hopefully tell a story about what I see so far, especially in Boca sources, that as the activities that clubs offer become broader, youth and women become dues-paying members as well. Even though I suspect they're participating in club activities before it's formalized as a formal club activity that dues-paying members sustain. There are, from early on, women's basketball teams, and there's in a few clubs sports that come in and out of existence that have a women's team. Basketball is one of them. Track and field's another. But aside from them appearing in those amateur athletics, they're organizing a lot of the social and cultural activities. They're participating in the Bibliotecas Populares as well. And yeah, they're in the stadiums as well. There's no kind of quantitative way to track this in the sources, but there's evidence in photographs, and there's also ways that in the press you can see this. There's women in the stadiums as well. Whiteness and middle class. Yeah. Especially starting in the 1950s, when there is, when the middle class becomes an explicitly political identity that's in reaction to Peronism, there's a way that I have to do some work, and I'm still thinking of how exactly to trace this out, but the Ciudad Deportiva is absolutely a space that is promoting a white middle class ideal as its family that will come in and consume that space. There is no mention of the middle class in any documents. There's no, you know, Armando doesn't talk about, you know, this is going to herald or boost a middle class kind of lifestyle. But it absolutely is a part of a set of activities that other scholars have traced through fashion, say blue jean choices, things like this, that I see myself taking that direction to trying to tease out how is this a part of a particular moment where the middle class is a very salient political identity, and it is a term that state officials are using explicitly and often. Frondizi is called the Perón of the middle classes, for example. That's kind of the directions that I'm going to go in to answer your questions. I don't think I have satisfactory answers for all of them right now. Ethnography as well, you were asking about as a method. I've since my arrival been very aware that it's just been kind of obvious that the archive's an ethnographic space, because the sources are piecemeal. People have kept them for different reasons. Either they're enthusiasts or private collectors, or they have a sense of it being useful politically in the future to hang on to these kinds of sources. So no source that I've encountered has not come without some kind of line of questioning about what I'm going to use it for and why they think it reflects a certain political standpoint of where soccer is these days and what soccer means to them these days, or what the club is doing, or how things used to be. It's also been really important for me to look at my interactions with Boca and all the officials that have opened up in a lot of ways their archival doors to me at Boca, even there is no official archive, as active political participants in a very contested space. And that, you know, it's not something that I retroactively think of is going to be something that I can apply to how other comisiones directivas have always worked, but it is a particular kind of field site that gets me closer to a political life that I am only getting at through sources and the media in the 40s and 50s and 60s.
Yeah, great. Congratulations. I didn't say that earlier. This is really exciting, and I think that archive as ethnographic space is really, it's a really exciting line, and thanks.
Thanks. Thanks, Melissa.
Great. Martha up if she's ready.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Alex. It is really good to see this, and coming after all these, seeing you going off to do field work and the rest. So when I was looking through this, what really struck me, in addition to one could have a whole question about transportation and city development, but that's not where I'm going to go, but of how health and the public good, hygiene, somewhat falling on Melissa's question here, how that figured so much in a sort of a reason for being, of for getting funding and part of the movements at this time, that this was really about health and hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from the sport and development arena and trying to, I find this really fascinating, is when I teach students, I actually say, well, sport and development isn't new. This is the same reasoning that people used a long time ago when they said, well, let's have a soccer club because it helps with the health of our youth and in our communities and in our barrios and things like that. So it's really exciting to see that so explicitly there. But what I was actually wondering, thinking, putting on the current, what happens in the sport and development field now, was what was the substance of that? And did anybody, were they held accountable for that in any particular way? So, and I know you had some early, you talked about how football, soccer was not initially seen as one of these sports because there is this whole, you know, the Swedish gymnastics thing, where there was a very specific scientific health curriculum. If you do this, do that. It had very specific ways of both in bodily individual health, but also community health.
Mm-hmm.
But did these clubs actually, or did people within the clubs come forward with some kind of curriculum, some kind of maybe campaigns of joining, you know, soccer, football with something else, you know, immunization or better eating, training outdoors, air? There's different ways it could come about. So was there some kind of explicit health program, curriculum program, or maybe a knock-on thing? Like nowadays, you know, you do sex education when you do sports, or HIV training, or, you know, how to use a condom, or those kinds of things kind of get added on to sport.
Mm-hmm.
So was there anything like that? And then did it at all, how well they did it matter when they went back to the trough, to the city leaders, to ask for more money or for more permissions to do what they need? Because it seemed like this was important for them to make their claim on resources, public resources.
Right.
That they had to say that they were. So did they have to show success? Or really, was it about, I mean, their success, was it really about the results, about the fans, about, you know, their political maneuvering, and the health was just a sort of a sticker on the outside?
Yeah, broadly speaking, it was more of a sticker. But that being said, there were real consistent and, depending on the club, kind of ever-present focused campaigns, programs, people who were staff members of the club who were part of Departamento de Educación Física. Uh-huh. So oftentimes the people that carried through the claims that club directors made when they said this is something that is going to promote the health of youth and the citizenry writ large, those were often people who were staff members in the Department of Physical Education, organizing amateur sports, coaching amateur sports, running programs for the youth and cadetes categories. At Boca, there's spots where I have in the sources existence, like proof of existence of some kind of an after-school youth program that is mainly focused on kind of activities, but could and sometimes did include like explicit things about hygiene and health. There's also a way that the club's academy systems were the places that directors, if there was, you know, an audit on how much hygiene good are you doing, they would say, you know, our youth players are all, you know, being well fed and have the best, you know, physical training, and we have scientific ways of preparing them for the first division that's going to help them no matter what, even if they don't make it, that are, you know, that are real in many ways. So after having said all that, though, ultimately, it is a way of securing subsidies, resources, support, more than I see it being something that clubs are overly concerned about being called out on. But that being said, it depends on the club. It depends on when. Depends on what kind of activity we're talking about. There's more exemplary clubs on this in the years that we're talking about. And then once we're past really the 70s and 80s, I think it's a different kind of study and conversations, because the way that clubes de barrio that are kind of romanticized, and there's a great film called Luna de Avellaneda, which is with, I think they're by law, Ricardo Darín has to be in every Argentine movie. He has to have some kind of cameo. But he's in it, and that's kind of the romanticized image of this is a neighborhood club that is, you know, small budget, is focused mostly on youth health. But that's kind of in a more contemporary context.
And so in some ways, not much has changed, especially for clubs, that it's the results that matter on the pitch more than anything in terms of, and maybe relationship with the fans.
Yeah. And even when, and this is another thing I meant to say, even when socios get upset about it and say, and get upset about it enough, and the club directors pay attention enough to actually include it in the official sources, and you can pick it up in the press as well, it's not a winning kind of political platform that an opposition can galvanize around. Like the directors aren't making good on their promises to provide services to the members or to really do a better job on that front. It's never really like driven anybody out, as long as the results are still coming in.
Mm-hmm. Sounds familiar. That's great. Thanks. Right.
Yep.
So Ed and East Lansing, and then I think if there's anybody else who wants to get in on a first round, or we could probably start a second round by the Skype message. But Ed, go ahead.
Okay. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks, Alex, too. But This certainly helps me as an advisor reading some of the early chapters, getting these reactions, giving me a lot to think about as well in terms of Alex's dissertation moving forward. So thanks very much, and what a great forum to explore these things in. I actually wanted to follow up a little bit on Melissa's question and maybe ask it in a slightly different way. I certainly found this kind of notion of consolidating a middle-class whiteness by the 50s and 60s to be quite intriguing. And I wonder, Alex, one thing that maybe you could think about a little bit, and something that we've talked about a little bit before, and I see a little bit in this chapter, but you don't make too explicit, is, and this also gets a little bit back to what Brenda was talking about earlier in terms of thinking comparatively. But, you know, one of the elements that you don't develop very much are kind of notions of race, nor do you develop much about kind of the mass immigration coming into Buenos Aires. Mm-hmm. And of course, there is a, you know, massive reaction on the part of especially elite sectors in Argentina, but others too, about kind of a fear of the crowd, a fear of the masses. You have kind of a really interesting study about how to control the crowd, how to make the crowd part of, you know, the right kinds of civic associations and all the kinds of arguments and questions about what those civic associations could be. So I guess I have just a few thoughts that I wanted to throw at you and kind of see how you responded to it. And that is kind of, if this is about kind of controlling the masses in one way or another, and the masses taking part. And I forgive me for using the term masses, but I'm just using that to kind of talk about some of the ways in which people would think about people at the time. But nonetheless, if this is in some ways about controlling, you know, whatever, the little blackheads, mm-hmm. or the the shirtless ones, if this is a way about making them into kind of respectable citizens, mm-hmm. Over the long term, I wonder, first, do you have a lot more reactions on the parts of elites to some of their fears of crowds and soccers, in crowds and soccer players and soccer fans? You mentioned this a little bit at first, that there was some resistance, that people didn't want to do soccer because it was seen as kind of a street game and that kind of thing. But it also seems to me that there's kind of fear of all these people maybe possibly coming together. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the clubs are kind of doing is they're, through their processes and practice in everyday life, and also through their associations, but they're turning this kind of around and saying that, no, you know, this kind of mass organization, people coming together under different kinds of processes in soccer, but then all the other things that the clubs are facilitating, is showing that, no, hey, you know, we are, in fact, respectable kinds of citizens. We are also disciplined in a way. And look at all the different kinds of activities that we're engaged in and that soccer kinds of allows us to do. So I just wonder if there's a way in which maybe the arc of the dissertation can be sort of can discuss how the soccer clubs become a medium through which you kind of have a controlled kind of participation that makes crowds palatable, that makes the integration of all kinds of suspect populations possibly palatable as well. And not to say that this is not a, you know, a process that's smooth by any means, it's very bumpy, but just to say that maybe this is part of what's going on with this, and this also helps us then to think about, you know, the emergence of populist programs, but then also very reactionary programs that are still trying to integrate the crowds and people in different kinds of way.
Yeah, I think a gap in the sources that I'm looking at in the first part of the 20th century that maybe I could fill, it might be interesting to answer this question, is that, you know, I'm in a lot of ways looking at soccer's biggest supporters, who also happen to fall into elite categories, like they're sold on the sports value. But, you know, the same jockey clubs or social clubs that they're a part of, I'm sure there's something to be found there about questioning, especially in its age of kind of where it's mainly just about filling large stadiums with largely disruly crowds, where there are concerns that maybe I can look at. I think when the clubs expand into more social activities, that is really kind of the legitimizing moment to see it as a tool of integration. And I think club directors realize quickly how much currency that argument has, which is why it kind of comes up again and again. And like we just talked about with Martha, even if it's not audited in a sense, like how is, and maybe that's where there's some interesting gaps to see where it's if there is no audit on the public good that clubs are kind of parroting constantly to the state, then there's probably interesting gaps there to find where this project of integration of acceptable citizenship, even if it's not just in the stadiums, but in the kinds of activities that are being organized, what Carnaval looks like, what the dances look like, that can maybe complicate like a wider narrative about how successful that project is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm sure there's some explicit stuff to look at it at the smaller clubs that maybe have a little bit more space to just be asking for municipal funds, and they don't have to be as concerned about a wider membership base that's going to be offended or policing the dance space as you know, a river might, right?
And then one other thing on the comparative question, you know, one thing that Brenda does such a nice job with is, in a country that actually has had very little in its historiography on it, is to bring out the question of race. Mm-hmm. Does race, racial constructions, the kinds of ethnicities that people are dealing with, does that come up in any appreciable way, either in your sources? And if it doesn't, you know, I mean, I think that that's a silence that maybe needs to be addressed on some levels.
Yeah, I think both. I think it does in the kind of mythology of where the club's identity lies. I mean, Boca is absolutely built up a mythology around the Genovese, and they are an Italian club. They have all kinds of markers and symbols of this. But from the very beginning, while it is a working class, primarily Genovese kind of set of members, La Boca is a very marginal space in the city. And so ethnic groups that aren't part of the integrationist narrative of Spaniards and Italians making up the kind of developing neighborhoods of the city, maybe that's where I can look for some of those silences and see when it becomes even more obvious in the 50s and 60s that immigration from the interior is bringing in people to the Boca that don't have European phenotypes and don't fit into that narrative. That's something I can bring out, yeah.
But as far as you know, they're sort of okay with joining a club that has an Italian kind of identity.
Yeah. It's not seen as problematic, but... Right. But now think.
Imagine that, Peter.
Peter just joined us from class. So. Yeah, and there's all kinds of, you know, like they're really, the website is available in Genovese.
Okay.
Like it's a very seriously taken performance that the club is, you know, sending.
Great. Looks like Danielle's up, and I'm also happy to turn things over to Peter if he's interested.
Yeah, Alex, thank you very much. Very interesting. I really enjoyed the discussion. Two questions. First of all, I mean, it's not common that a dissertation is also residing in a documentary. So how do you address this in the methodology section of your work? And the second question is, in this trailer, one old man said, if this Sport City project would have been realized, Boca would play today in the European Champions League.
Uh-huh.
Can you maybe comment on this?
Yeah, he's the same guy who insisted that the website appear in Genovese. So yeah, the documentary is a really interesting thing to talk about with a dissertation, because the documentary was a collaborative effort with four young journalists. In a lot of ways, that work was and remains a space where I'm interacting with people who know a lot more than me on some things, but I'm filling in the major turns of the story itself. So that's been, in terms of methodology, it's been a rich space for me to have people to talk about my arguments and my narrative with that are Argentines and not soccer sociologists or historians that are coming at this from a journalistic perspective. So on the method side, it's been a way for me to have yet another perspective on the sources that keep me thinking about how an Argentine audience would engage with the material of the dissertation and the arguments that I'm making. And it's also been very, in a very practical and pragmatic speaking way too, like a point where I ask lots of questions and I need to know what I'm talking about constantly. I can't kind of get away with muddying over parts of my argument that I know aren't gonna fit. It's also been,
I mean, I think you maybe had more access to much more sources, right? With this project.
Yes.
Which would have not had if you would have done just desk research.
For sure. There was a way in which this was I had the base archival, materials in place when we started collaborating, and we've been able to add to that base. And we all learned how to use Zotero. We have a group library. They've contributed sources to. They've annotated things that I already have annotated, so I have another set of eyes and ears on that. And yeah, the gaps that they identified as interesting parts of the story, we've gone out and found more sources on together. So yeah, it's been an enriching experience for the sources and how I interact with the sources. In another way, it's also kept the structure of the dissertation on the forefront of the table, because when we've sorted out the chapters of how we're telling the story and the kinds of questions we ask to people that I also did separate oral histories with, that, you know, when we talked to them for the documentary, we could ask things in different ways and they had a different person in front of them asking the question. And it was very interesting to see how they answered questions for me slightly differently than they answered questions for them. Mm. So overall, it's been, you know, a great boon to the work. It's been a lot more work, but it's moving along. The Champions League question, what was your question? What he meant by that, or how he saw that as a possibility?
I mean, I assume you want to say it would be one of the greatest clubs in the world.
Yeah.
And by the way, I have to say this because we have a relative in Bolivia who sleeps in Boca bed clothes, so he would certainly agree. But I mean, I think that's a question. So do you think this was like, like a missed road to become like what is Barcelona maybe today, like a global brand that is unmatched?
Yeah, I think more interesting than if it would actually possible, which is interesting in itself. I think both things. I mean, I don't think he's just kind of shooting his mouth off and it's pure hubris. I mean, Sergio's a smart guy, who's not prone to those kinds of statements, actually. So I think Sergio really means that. He being a historian as well, he's the president of the club's Subcomisión de Historia. He sees this moment in the 50s and 60s as a very successful period for the club. They won 5 titles in the 1960s. They had a president who was the 10th richest man in Argentina. He had, a very established mode of interacting with all the parties that would usually provide support to clubs in terms of the municipality and the federal government. And the plan that the Ciudad Deportiva was supposed to set in motion would be to radically expand the membership base of the club. He talked about River having 80,000 members at the time. He wanted to have 200,000 members. And the kind of raffle tickets / bonds, you know, support títulos that he sold for the support of the project, they sold many, many, many abroad to the Argentine Society in New York and in Europe. And he got the idea for the Ciudad Deportiva by visiting casino on the water in, say, Monaco or there's racing there. Anyway, he got the idea from a place that he visited in Europe and said, this is a way to bring that kind of space to Buenos Aires. So it's, and he also was a fervent believer that the Silla Portilla would anchor a whole kind of renaissance of the Southern Port District, the kind of derelict Southern Port District. So as crazy as that sounds, I think he really believes in it. I think the interesting realities that make it a little bit kind of more imaginable is that, you know, I think the move has always been to look at Boca and River as clubs that are unique in the Argentine soccer scene, and that because they've had such international success, they've beaten kind of the best teams in the world for international trophies, that why not have, a consolidated Champions League that would bring in, the clubs in South America that that often had players moving between them and still, you know, to this day in a more unequal way, are moving back and forth. It makes more sense in the perspective of the 1960s than it might today.
Well, we have an example from rugby. What is it? The Super 14 now, where teams from Australia, teams from New Zealand, teams from South Africa played again. And then the four nations of rugby includes Argentina, South Africa, New Zealand, and Australia. So, and the NBA is playing in Europe. The NFL is playing in Europe and Latin America in some places. So. Right.
Yeah, now it makes more sense too.
I think the queue is temporarily empty. I could jump in with a question, or Peter, you'd be welcome to jump in with a question.
Yeah, I'd be glad to jump in with a comment / question. I don't know what's been said, so I apologize for covering ground that already has been covered, but I really enjoyed the paper, and I learned a lot about Buenos Aires as much as I learned about soccer, which was, I always look for that in these kinds of works. And but I also saw there were kind of two separate chapters in a way in this. And we talked a little bit about this last night, Alex and I, but I wonder what other people in the group might think too. It seems to me that, the period of Perón only gets about, 6 or 7 pages. And
it's the intro, and then you come back to it right at the end.
Yeah, sure. But like the deep analysis, it's kind of 6 or 7 pages more or less. And it seems to me, the coup is 43, then he's elected in 46 or something like that. I'm a little forgetful here, maybe. But it seems to me that that's a completely different period. You know, you've got this initial period that's foundational, where the clubs are amateur, they have their wooden stadiums, they're growing, the media landscape is maturing in Buenos Aires, and that leads us into the big stadium building frenzy of the 30s with the first state subsidies. But it seems to me that that's a different era from what you get under Perón, the social justice and soccer section that you described. So are you thinking at all about perhaps expanding that final section of the paper into a chapter of its own, where you can deal with Peronism and its impact on Buenos Aires and Boca and football in general? Because it seems to me that there's still a legacy today. I mean, the elections are around the corner, and the Peronist representatives are major figures, of course, and Boca has Macri in the race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about this a little bit last night. I thought a little bit more about it. I'm ultimately going to take the end of the first chapter and put it into the second chapter, because the second chapter, Ed's the only one that's read it, but it opens again with Peronism, but in a different lens. So I'm talking about stadium construction, speaking to the state subsidies at the end of the first chapter. But then I open up the second chapter by talking about what is the landscape of consumption in the city. And so I again start with Peronism. So it's not Peronism in soccer explicitly, though it comes through, but I'm kind of resetting kind of the reader's expectations at the start of that chapter to talk about consumption that I think probably works better if I bring in the stadiums as part of that conversation, rather than saying, here's how Peronism changed the landscape consumption in the city, but you've already read about the stadiums in the last, because I think they're very much related, because a lot of the arguments that are being made on, you know, shaping youth and shaping a certain kind of citizenship also has to do with access to a certain kind of entertainment, a certain kind of consumption that's, you know, now consolidated in the clubs in terms of how the diverse activities that you can participate in the club are in place by the 40s. So yeah, I think I'm gonna take the end of the first chapter and put it at the first part of the second chapter.
So the next chapter is not on on Armando?
The next chapter is...
Because it ends here saying you're basically foreshadowing what's coming. It's, mm-hmm. You say, as Boca continued to expand and adapt, club president Alberto Armando developed an ambitious plan to create an indelible mark on the city of Nid. That doesn't go into the mid-50s?
Yeah, it does.
So Perón is already out of the picture.
Yeah, but it starts again at, like, the... It starts really in the 1940s to contextualize why... What happens in the 1950s?
Okay, I guess that's what I'm getting at. Is that it seems to me that you're using the Perón period maybe too much as a contextual mm-hmm. hook rather than a period that in and of itself might deserve a little deeper analysis that only a full chapter could really accord it. I mean, I don't know. From the outside, I think that decade of Argentinian history is Peronism mm-hmm. in a way. I may be wrong on that, but it seems to me that if it deserves maybe fuller scrutiny, because then maybe the consumption stuff is how do you say this? Its meaning mm-hmm. will be clearer after you've dealt with the political and economic changes that take place under Perón and how they affect Saga and society. I'm just thinking out loud as someone who is not a Latin Americanist or you know, an Argentinian. Mm-hmm. But leave it at that.
Yeah, the second chapter is what it does is it explores kind of where modernizing Buenos Aires comes from. So I'm looking at the development of a developmentalist conversation that the clubs have to enter into, that I go back to Peronism to contextualize. But I think you're right. It makes more sense to have it be...
instead of going like this.
Together, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think of Osvaldo Soriano and his books. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much of that is speaks to that period, mm-hmm. you know, growing up as a kid, you know, as a boy who is loving football and it's and being in love with Perón and the whole idea early on, you know, in your naive teenage years, perhaps, but also wrapped up in that euphoria, if you want to call it that.
Well, I guess one of the big questions is how much, to what extent do you see the Ciudad Deportiva mm-hmm. Either working into some of the dynamics of crowds, some of the dynamics of popular consumption mm-hmm. under Perón, mm-hmm. or to what extent you find that to be something that's really different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, is the developmentalist state afterwards, you mentioned before, I mean, there is an element in Peronism that's very much about sort of creating, mm-hmm. you know, families that'll mm-hmm. go out and take part in activities and this kind of thing. That's something that the developmentalist state after Perón seems mm-hmm. very much to pick up on. That's the kind of thing that the Ciudad Deportiva mm-hmm. taps into. But on the other hand, you know, it's also the case that they're trying to minimize the sort of intense mobilization that happens under Perón. Mm-hmm. They're repressing mm-hmm. Armando and others who seem to be explicit Peronists mm-hmm. and the sort of apolitical discourse that grants legitimacy to these clubs mm-hmm. Has to come much more to the fore mm-hmm. after Peronism.
Right.
And so I guess one of the questions is just then to tease out what is the sort of big transformation that you can tell through your story out of Peronism, and maybe what are some of the continuities, if there are some. Mm-hmm. And that also could help the narrative, or that might answer the narrative question, right? And I do think it probably requires more space, or... Mm-hmm. It would act, I mean... there's a level of which, you know, everybody who writes about, you know, 20th century Argentine politics has to write a shitload on Peronism. and it would actually be really interesting if your story told something that would, you know, that upset that narrative in some ways. But I'm not sure that that's the case. And there's a reason why Peronism gets all the attention that it does. So, I mean, it's just, I think maybe something to think about as you're moving forward.
I think
that's what the narrative arc is in terms of the kinds of changes that you're tracing as soccer is becoming this public spectacle, but also one that's supposed to be about a kind of acceptable form of family consumption, and then as it changes into neoliberalism.
Does Daniel have a question?
Yeah, it does not fit to the discourse on Peronism, but I mean, one of the topics Boca is famous for, unfortunately, in the international media, is fan violence. Is this something that has, like, I mean, is this like a past dependency? I mean, has this historic roots? Was there, like, always fan violence, or is this a relatively recent phenomenon?
There always has been, but yeah, there's things that don't approach, you know, anywhere near the scale or the kinds of violence that we see even in the, you know, from really the formation of clubs. There's violence in the stadiums throughout. People die in the 10s, 20s, 30s. There are organized groups that, you know, are violent towards one another even. But the Barra Brava as an institutionalized part of the club's governance is something that is unique to the 1950s and 60s, and there is a series of directors that understand what the barras are and how to use the barras that makes it different after the 1950s and 60s. Now, there's interesting things to talk about contextualizing that in kind of national political and economic scene, but largely, I think, from what I've seen, and I've yet to kind of write explicitly on this, it's coming in the next chapter, but I see the transformation of violence in this organized way happen in the 50s and 60s as barras becoming institutionalized and being in some senses unofficially on the payroll of certain boards of directors, also allows them to become more sophisticated in their organization to what we see them being involved in today, which is beyond club violence. They are, you know, small to large time criminal organizations that have their fingers in other pies other than, you know, the club providing, you know, money or buses or merchandise. It's more sophisticated than that now.
But so are you saying that there was more kind of stadium violence outside and then in the 50s and 60s as they become more institutionalized, as you have more socios who are involved in the project of Ciudad Deportiva and all the activities that are club about, that you see less of that?
No, I see more of it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I see more of it. And, but there's also a way in which it's very specific in some ways. It's controlled. It's violence inside of the groups themselves as people jockey for positions inside the group. And then that kind of barra is different from, you know, the fourth division barra that's really out there just, you know, to participate in this code of defending the colors and getting into fights and, you know, might also be involved in criminal activities, but there's no club to give them, you know, transportation places or lucrative merchandise, or, you know, Boca is very famous that the barra is in many ways sustained by selling tickets to foreigners. Very lucrative activity for them. You know, somebody shows up at the official, you know, tourism office at the club, and then they're handed over to somebody else who is a member of the barra, and it's all controlled, but it's, you know, a couple $100 to go see a game. Yeah. And there's all kinds of ways that the socios, you know, are aware and criticize this and are very upset about it. They say, you know, we have these socios adherentes who, you know, basically have a lottery system and pay lots of money and they never get into the stadium. Then we have, you know, the season ticket holders that get less and less allocations. And then, more and more we see large portions of the stadium being given to tourists or dignitaries or, you know. Yeah, Andrew, you have one.
Yeah, I'm a little reluctant. There's been so many good questions, and as a non,
but you've moderated, so you
yeah,
well deserved.
You well deserved. Yeah,
abided my time. And I'm probably going to ask a question I think a lot of historians don't like. But one of the things that I read in the chapter that was interesting to me, it felt like you were hinting at some of the ways that the historical record on this particular situation might inform the broader discussion in contemporary stadium politics and the kind of general argument that, you know, stadium projects are often presented as apolitical, but mm-hmm. obviously they're actually very political. Mm-hmm. And it just was striking to me as someone who, again, is not a Latin Americanist, doesn't know much about the history of this, that how many of the arguments just are very familiar to contemporary arguments about stadiums. And whether I'm sort of right to read some hints in there that you think there's some insight in this example towards those more contemporary debates, and if so, what some of those insights might be.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of interesting ways, in maybe a surprising way, that there is things to be looked at in the history that complicate the argument that stadiums can't be engines of transformation in neighborhoods. That being said, it's a very particular time with a very particular understanding of what is going to happen in that stadium, and it's ultimately a civic association that has very real obligations and very real plans for what they're going to do with that space. So ultimately, I think, you know, what I think this would be, I think people who are interested in that kind of a subject of, you know, how do we better understand claims that people make about stadiums and urban development and what kind of development that means, and you know, mega events to just, you know, the new stadium that whatever franchise asks for in that particular city, is that it's ultimately a very particular kind of space that has a very particular kind of consumption that's taking place there that doesn't meet oftentimes the kind of arguments that are being put forward to justify public investment in it. But, you know, there's also an interesting story to be told about the public investments that went into these stadiums in the 1930s and 40s and how they did change neighborhoods. But I don't think they're really, it's kind of apples and oranges for what kinds of arguments are made for, you know, the Maracanã to be redeveloped or refurbished, you know?
Yeah, kind of, although kind of not. I mean, that's part of what's interesting is, well, while it is a very particular case, it also seems to operate on some underlying similarities, which is sort of a universal theme that no matter how untrue it is, gets recycled over and over, you know?
Yeah, and the durability of it, yeah, for sure.
That's part of what's interesting to me, to read it in the context of Boca, because so many parts of it, while obviously particular, are also just extraordinarily universal. And it just raises the question for me of, you know, why is this universal narrative so easy to grasp onto, no matter the historical context, even when there are so many particularities? But anyway, that's a sort of a...
No, I think it's an interesting question, yeah. Right at 90 minutes.
Right at 90 minutes, and maybe we should see. We had only the one substitution, so that'd be about 30 seconds of extra time. Right?
Should I fall on the ground and roll around like the Argentinian players do in the 90th minute?
No, I don't know. Alex, if you want to put in a final word and wrap it up, I'd be happy to defer.
No, I just... Thanks everyone for making time to talk about my work with me. It's in a lot of ways, it reflects, you know, the development that I've been able to enjoy having this group. So, you know, if there's anything good in here, you can be somewhat proud of it. If there's anything bad, I blame all of you. Thanks again, Andrew, as well, for for moderating.
Yes, pleasure. Thanks for a good conversation, everyone, and that was good fun.
Yeah, and one last thing. Our next session is on December 1st. We're going to be doing a recap of the Women's World Cup, so stay tuned for announcements about that.